Today in Studio 360, we talk to Hollywood's current king of pop noir, David Fincher. He makes movies like Fight Club and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo with a fanatic precision, but
90% of anything I've ever shot, if I was given the chance, I would redo it.
Fincher's new film, Gone Girl, is kind of a realistic horror movie about marriage. And for a different view of that sacred institution, I'll talk with the actor Jenny Slate, who seems to have a great working relationship with her director husband.
What I loved about him, why I wanted him to stay forever, was I thought of a life together where we could just make stuff.
For starters, they made the viral hit Marcel the Shell with shoes on.
Guess what I wear as a hat?
What?
A lentil.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and lots more is ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Delta Airlines, whose new Delta Studio provides more streaming entertainment in the sky. Movies, shows, even live TV, all on your personal devices. Learn more at Delta.com. Delta. Keep climbing.
This is Kurt Anderson, and today in Studio 360, I'll talk with Jenny Slate, the comedian who is succeeding at everything she does these days. YouTube, movies, TV, children's books. And we'll take a look at a strange trend in this fall's movie theaters. Actors, great actors, playing has-been, washed-up versions of themselves. But we'll start the show with a filmmaker who's really a trend unto himself.
First you have to know, not fear, know that someday you're gonna die.
If you want to make a dark, smart, complicated, but very popular movie in Hollywood, David Fincher is the go-to guy. He made the serial killer movie Seven and Fight Club, and he got House of Cards made. He even managed to fill the Facebook movie, Social Network, with the damaged maleness in which he seems to specialize. His latest film, Gone Girl, is based on the best-selling Gillian Flynn novel about a man whose wife goes missing.
Beautiful wife, handsome husband.
Wife goes missing on her anniversary.
Nick Dunn, did you kill your wife?
We need to prepare your defense. And if we decide to go with your version of the truth.
David Fincher, welcome to Studio 360.
It's nice to be here.
You got interested as a little boy in making movies. Was there a single moment or a single movie or a single TV show or something you saw where you really thought, not I just like this or that was cool, but like, I want to do this?
Yeah. I was about 7 years old. And I was watching network television because that's all there was. And there was a documentary on the making of George Roy Hill's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And I just saw this making of. And it was the first time it ever occurred to me that movies weren't made in real time. That if you watched a movie that took 2 hours, that it was probably made in a couple afternoons. You know, if it was complicated, maybe it could take a week. But it never occurred to me that it took months and months and months. So I watched this and I was just, you get to blow up full-size balsa wood trains. You get cowboys on horseback and you get to hang out with Catherine Ross. This sounds like a pretty good job.
But it also, it's interesting because it was this adult idea of, ooh, this takes forever and it's hard, which is attracted to you. Maybe you had the little adult in you.
Yeah. I mean, I've always been interested in how things work. You know, not watches, but I've always been interested in process and procedure. And, you know, my father could explain a lot of things about – I mean, he could explain persistence of vision. He could explain animation and, you know, rostering cameras.
He was a writer for Life magazine and a science writer. So he was – that was a good dad for you to have.
Yeah.
Were you – as a young person into crime stories and thrillers and psychos and stuff?
Well, I grew up in Marin County in San Francisco Bay Area during Zodiac. And I was one of those kids on the bus being followed by the California Highway Patrol. And I remember very distinctly going to ask my father, you know, my dad, who was always very, very dry, he turned in his chair, took off his glasses and said, oh, right, yes, well – there is a serial killer currently at work in the area where we live, and he has threatened to shoot out the tires of a school bus with a high-powered rifle and pick off the kids as they come out of the school bus. And
how old were you when you got this news?
I was about seven.
Wow.
Six or seven.
Wow.
And I remember thinking, you know, you could drive us. Like, you're a stay-at-home dad. You're a journalist, for f***ing sake. So,
people think of your movie Seven and Fight Club as super grisly.
Really?
People do.
No, this I've heard this said. I've overheard people saying this.
One of your tricks as a director, almost
I only
like,
have four. So let's
really,
let, yeah, let's
as a sort of it's well, it strikes me as a kind of magician's idea to make them feel the violence and not necessarily show it. There's the famous example. I want to play the clip from the last scene of Seven. And for the people who have not seen Seven, spoiler alert, pause. Okay, the detective, played by Morgan Freeman, opens a cardboard box and tries to warn his partner, played by Brad Pitt, to stay away.
California, stay away from here. Stay away from here now. Don't come in here. Whatever you hear, stay away. John Doe has the upper hand.
Mills!
Here he comes.
So everybody remembers that scene as horrific, but you never actually show the horrific thing, which is to say Brad Pitt's wife's severed head in this box, even though people think they saw it after they watched that movie. Is that a sort of narrative sleight of hand thing that you like doing to just – rather than just saying, here, show it to him?
The construction of that movie, which was decided upon and delineated by Andrew Walker, who wrote the script, was really kind of brilliant in that it didn't require you to actually see anybody strapped to a chair having horrible things done to them. You saw the aftermath. The movie is challenging your ability to empathize with something that you can imagine must have happened. They inspire as opposed to confirm your worst fears. But I think that the genius of Seven is it taps into a part of you that for me was the most frightening thing about serial killers. We live in a world where we can't get the guy who lives through the paper-thin walls to turn down Jeopardy, you know, and yet we have no idea that just beyond him somebody's running power tools in the middle of the night and there's – you know, a 50-gallon drum filled with, you know, body parts. So this is happening amongst us. The monster lives amongst us. And getting back to your original point, which is we have to open a box and there has to be this horrifying revelation. And we had Morgan Freeman. So I didn't feel any need to have to cast a rubber head and fill the box full of gristle.
You didn't even shoot it?
Never.
And then in terms of preying upon people's grisly imaginations versus showing it. In Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, it requires some pretty grisly, explicit, graphic sexual violence, killing, all the rest. Was that hard for you to do, being more a master of the
– I still feel that there's – I mean the violence that you do see in Dragon Tattoo – let's just say this. Nothing's left to the imagination. But nothing is explicitly shown because we would have had to cut it out of the movie. It's an R-rated movie. So it's that, you know, it's that thing of what is it? You know, Monty Python, it's cruel but fair. You know, I kind of like – it's like, yes, it's completely lascivious and merciless and tastefully done.
With both Gone Girl and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, you have adapted these enormous
girl novels.
Well,
novels
among other
girl
things,
in the title.
Girl in the title and enormous bestsellers. Gone Girl has 6 million some copies sold worldwide, about 4 million of those in the United States alone. You have the problem that people who make Harry Potter movies have of fans saying, oh, is he going to mess it up? Is it? But you also have, with this particular novel, the problem of these – a suspenseful mystery based on these particular late-in-the-game twists that people who've read the novel know. Does that worry you? Did that worry you?
Well, look, if 6 million people have read the book and all of them get a plus one to go see the movie, and that's all the money that we make, we're going to lose $50 million. So I don't think it's that you don't make a movie. You can't make a movie right. for the people who read the book. But I try not to sweat that stuff yep. because there's always – everybody has an opinion, you know, and very few people have to take responsibility for the $50 million that it takes to get the movie made. So you take the responsibility, but if you're going to listen to everyone, you'd never get anything done.
You can't worry about it all.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to I mean, I don't live in a hermetically sealed world, but I try.
I want to play a clip from Gone Girl. This is early on at a party where Nick, played by Ben Affleck, meets his future wife, Amy, played by Rosamund Pike.
Amy, who are you?
A, I'm an award-winning scrimshander. B, I'm a moderately influential warlord. C, I write personality quizzes for magazines.
Okay. Well, your hands are far too delicate for real scrimshaw work. And I happen to be a charter subscriber to Middling Warlord Weekly, so I recognize you. I'm going to go with C.
And you? Who are you?
I'm the guy to save you from all this awesomeness.
And they get married, and then a few years later, when things aren't going so well between them, she disappears. Over the course of the movie, we start to realize that she is more complicated than she seemed at the start. I wonder why you chose Rosamund Pike in particular to play this difficult role.
Well, in my head was this sort of statuesque. I mean, you know, Ben is 6'4", and so you can have somebody who's 4'11" next to somebody. It's you end up like building up the sidewalks in order to put them in the same frame.
Or hiring Tom Cruise to replace Ben Affleck, I guess.
It occurred to me that I had seen her in 4 movies and that I didn't really have a hit on her. I didn't really have a take. I'm somebody who, I mean, all I do all day is watch actors lie to me. So, you know, if that's what you do for, you know, 14 hours a day is watch TV and assess, yeah, it's believable. That's not believable enough. We need to do another one. I'm pretty confident in being able to say that I can see your utility belt. I can see your toolkit. I can see how many arrows you have in your quiver. I am one of those people who kind of I get a take on people pretty rapidly, and I had no take on her. And I thought, that's really actually an important thing for Amy. Amy has to be one of those people that you kind of – she's opaque in a way. And the other thing was I met her. She flew out to St. Louis. After it was about 2 hours into dinner, I turned to her and I said, are you an only child? And she said, yeah, as a matter of fact. And she told me about her whole upbringing. And it suddenly occurred to me, she's an orchid. She's a hothouse flower. She's been around adults her whole life, and she just is different. So once we got past the how physically dedicated will you be to this, she had these other things going for her that I just thought, I think she'll be great.
In the novel, Nick comes across as much more of a jerk than he does in the movie. Did you and Gillian Flynn feel you had to make him more likable as sort of the hero?
I don't think that there's anything in my past work that would suggest that I'm uncomfortable with the idea of
I know.
Characters who are unlikable. The book is very much two subjective points of view, warring.
The husband, the wife doing their first-person thing.
Yeah. He said, she said. So it's kind of like who are you going to side with?
And it's a very literary stunt.
It's a totally literary conceit. And if somebody comes in and tries to do a two-handed Rashomon, we're going to have a problem with this movie because there's no sort of entry point for the audience.
Yeah.
And Gillian, she got that. As the person who engineered it, when she did her first pass of the screenplay, she threw out the subjectivity of the he said. And instead of having Nick tell you his side of the story, you have to witness him dealing with information as it is uncovered about the disappearance of his wife.
Yeah. Do you wish you could write? You don't write your movies.
Do I wish I could write?
Yeah.
No, I don't wish that on anyone. No, I live the writer. I have no interest in that. Aside from what they will tell you, I'm actually kind of a social person. I don't
people.
The people, those people that you keep talking about. I don't like the idea of like going into a room and saying five pages today, come hell or high water. That to me is that's terrifying. I mean, my job is watercolors from three blocks away with 90 people holding the brush through binoculars.
And that's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
Are there directors whose work you look at and say, that work and that career, if I could have something like that, that's my model?
No. I think no. So when I look back at George Roy Hill's work, you know, who's an important filmmaker for me, or Alfred Hitchcock's work, Steven Spielberg's or Roman Polanski's or George Lucas's or, you know, Michael Ritchie's, you know, there are people whose work was at a moment in time you just went, wow, you know, Bad News Bears, where did this come from? This is insane. Or the Alien, you know, you look at these movies and you and they impart something to you at that moment in time. But all of these people who have come before to do this weird job, you know, of sort of herding cats, you know, there's always going to be some of their work that you just, you know, you can't believe how perfectly it worked out for them. And if you were to corral them in at the end of a bar at some night and really pick their brains, they would probably go, oh, really? You like that? You know, it's a very different thing watching someone else's work than it is understanding
your own.
Yeah. What it is to do it. You know, Martin Scorsese once said to me something that was really interesting because we were talking about style. He said, remember, the things that you do badly are as much a part of your style as the things that you do well. Because if everybody did it the way they wanted to do it straight out of the gate, you know, every movie would look like Citizen Kane.
It sounds like, though, you probably have this is the thing I'm proudest of that I've ever done. Do you have that? No.
Nope.
You can't decide between among the children?
Like, yeah, exactly. This is the child you're most proud of? Yeah. No.
But the movie won't care, unlike your daughter or something.
No, it's given the chance, 90% of anything I've ever shot, if I was given the chance, I would redo it. Now I know what it is. When you string a movie together, when you finally see it, you know, beginning to end, that's the only time you're, you know, really, really qualified to talk about it. You know, you were shooting out of the United States, out of continuity, trying to work one actor, get all of their scenes done in 13 days so they can go off to do their play. You know, there's all these extenuating circumstances that turn this Rubik's Cube into a really difficult proposition. And so it's all, you know, we joke all the time in the movie business, but it's only when you finished the movie that you're really qualified to be able to tell anybody how to make it, because that's where you finally go, that's where the weight should be. This, we should have 3 days for instead of twos. That's when it becomes clear.
David Fincher, we could go on all day, but thank you very much.
Sure, no problem.
David Fincher's latest film, Gone Girl, just opened everywhere. And if you're a David Fincher fan and want some more, the two of us had a terrific conversation that lasted the better part of an hour. You can hear the whole thing online at studio360.org. Coming up, have you seen the one about the aging has-been movie star played by an aging movie star who really has seen some better days?
Everyone likes a comeback story. Everybody wants to see someone who's fallen on his face get back up.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and that's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
I'll be back.
Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Delta Airlines, whose long-haul fleet has not only more flatbed seats, but more flatbed seats available with direct aisle access. Learn more at delta.com. Delta, keep climbing.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Throughout this year, we are following a few brave listeners who back in January told us about their creative New Year's resolutions. One of them is Julie Bailey, who listens to our show on WNYC. She was a stand-up comic years ago, but gave that up for a real job, a career in advertising. She resolved to make 2014 the year that she stepped back up to the mic. And Julie Bailey is with me on the line right now. Hello, Julie.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. So how's your resolution going?
Well, I have to tell you, I don't want to quote Langston Hughes, but I will. What happens to a dream deferred? I started out really well at the beginning of the year. I was working and writing every day, and then I got seriously ill, unfortunately, and I ended up having some pretty major surgery, so that was one sidetrack. But I kind of put my nose back to the grindstone and tried to be funny, but it kind of fell by the wayside, and I feel as if I'm not on track to be on stage this year. I'm getting it back, but I don't know, 2015, Kurt?
Yeah, well, we can make extensions. But do you feel in general, since you did this professionally when you were 20-something, as an older person, as a middle-aged person, do you feel like, wow, it's harder to be funny about life given its vicissitudes?
You know what? You raised such an interesting and good point, because for a while there, I was writing things that were more just angry and, you know, quite frankly, this summer has not been a great summer for our country with Ferguson and ISIL. And, you know, I just realized, you know what? The older I get, I am finding things laughable, but not necessarily funny,
yeah.
If you understand what
yeah.
I'm trying to say.
Absolutely understand that. So do you think there's a real possibility for you at your age now and in this new world to make comedy again?
Yeah, for a minute there, I said, oh, Jules, just forget this. You're never going to do it. But there's still that voice inside of me that says, no, you know what? There's still something there. You just got to really find it, and you've got to find a way to make who was is now. And I don't know yet how to do that, but I know that I'm not going to stop trying. It's not going to be this year. You know?
I understand. And I hope you're not angry at us for ensnaring you in this plot, this devilish plot.
No, absolutely. The only thing is I feel like I'm talking to my dad and I failed my dad.
I'm not your dad. Your brother,
I know.
Maybe.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. But, you know, my brother, I wouldn't care that much.
Yeah. Well, I wish you the best of luck. And if suddenly between now and the end of the year you decide, no, I've got it again, let us know.
You know that I absolutely will.
Julie, it is always a pleasure talking to you, and I hope we stay in touch.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you so much for this opportunity. You guys are the best.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Julie Bailey lives in Brooklyn, New York. So, listeners, do you have any advice for her, words of wisdom? If so, tell us at studio360.org. And, you know, it's already October, not too early to start thinking about the creative New Year's resolutions you might make for 2015. We'll ask you for them in a couple of months. The Oscar movie season is approaching, not when they give out the awards, but when all the Oscar bait films appear in theaters. You know, the kind with serious themes, big name directors, and stars not playing superheroes or being funny. This year, a bunch of those Oscar targeting movies have an unusual premise in common. We asked Studio 360's Eric Molinsky to find out what gives.
Between October 1987 in April 1988, 4 movies came out where people swapped bodies, or their souls were placed in the wrong bodies. There was Big with Tom Hanks, 18 Again with George Burns, Like Father, Like Son with Dudley Moore, and Vice Versa with Judd Reinhold. What did this trend say about America in the late 1980s? Probably nothing. These things just happen sometimes. But Rafer Guzman says I shouldn't dismiss trends that quickly. He's a film critic for WNYC's Movie Date podcast, which is produced by The Takeaway.
It's hard to say this is what America is thinking, quote unquote, but you do see little trends that come up now and then.
And those trends can still tell us something about what people are thinking. Like this year, no fewer than 5 movies are coming out where a famous actor plays a has-been version of himself or herself. There's Al Pacino in The Humbling.
Who is it?
It's your agent!
You've got to do something. You have no money.
Why don't you get me a deal writing my memoirs? Isn't that what washed-up actors do?
There's Clouds of Sils Maria, where Juliette Binoche is a former ingenue who now has to play the role of the older woman.
I played Sigrid when I was 18.
And because you were Sigrid, only you can be Helena.
Julianne Moore feels threatened by up-and-comers in David Cronenberg's Maps to the Stars.
Am I better looking than her?
You want that role, but you're not gonna get it.
And then things get surreal in the Congress.
Robin, things are changing quickly.
Where Robin Wright sells a virtual version of herself to a movie studio. And then things get really meta in Birdman.
Hey, is this for real or are you shooting a film?
A film!
Michael Keaton plays an actor whose career floundered after he quit playing a superhero.
You're Birdman.
All these films are echoing the great Sunset Boulevard, where Gloria Swanson played Norma Desmond, a star of silent movies who wallowed in her own nostalgia.
You're Norma Desmond. Used to be in silent pictures. Used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Hollywood wasn't really accustomed to lifting its veil back then, where things were very tightly controlled, personas were very tightly controlled. It was unusual, I think, to see someone kind of break the fourth wall in such a self-referential, unflattering way.
What's striking about these new movies is that today's stars are very willing to make fun of themselves.
They all want to act. These are all actors. And they're looking for good, juicy roles. So I think all of them see in these parts a chance for a better role for them.
Christine Holmlund is a professor of film at the University of Tennessee, and she's written about how Hollywood deals with aging.
Pacino's the oldest at 72. I believe he really himself was interested in buying the script for The Humbling. And both of the women, although they are still glamorous and younger, comparatively speaking.
She means Julianne Moore and Juliette Binoche.
It's really tough for women over 40 to get lead roles in Hollywood, even supporting roles.
I also talked with some producers and others in the movie business, and they had no clue what to make of this trend. They actually hadn't even noticed it. Maybe that's because these satires of stardom were all developed outside the studio system. 4 of the 5 directors are foreign. But Rafer Guzman says these kinds of art house films still make commercial sense. They're just aimed at a different marketplace, an aging marketplace.
There are a lot of older movie stars now and movies with older storylines about the experiences of older people now. I do think movies know that that audience, let's call it the graying audience, that they're out there and they are still seeing movies pretty faithfully.
Even The Expendables, the Stallone franchise where every action star from the 80s spoofs himself, is a variation of this theme.
I'm almost out. I'll be back.
You've been back enough. I'll be back.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Expendables laugh at the fact of aging and want to strike a blow for aging actors.
Again, here's Christine Holmlund.
But then again, wasn't Stallone always somehow used up, even back in 1975 with Rocky? So in some ways, he's still doing his stock in trade.
The gimmick is not going to be enough for viewers to bring an actual audience in. It still has to have a story that people can relate to.
Of all these movies, the one generating the most buzz is Birdman, because Michael Keaton really has been down and out in his career. And it feels relevant because it's commenting on Hollywood's big cash cow, superheroes.
Keaton has been smart. He's popped up here and there in these little weird roles over the past couple of years, and he's just completely fantastic. He's hilarious, super high energy, really funny, really just grabs you by the throat. But in a way, it makes for a very good setup for Birdman. Everyone likes a comeback story. Everybody wants to see someone who's fallen on his face get back up.
Especially if that face has a few wrinkles. For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
You can find out more about this curious new crop of movies and their pretend washed-up stars at our website, studio360.org. Coming up next, Jenny Slate lost her job on Saturday Night Live and got a new gig and voice as a tiny snail, Marcel the Shell.
Guess why the bus isn't running?
Why?
Because the bus is a caterpillar and it threw up.
Actor, comedian, and best-selling children's author, Jenny Slate.
I'm Marcel the Shell, and you're listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from PRI and WNYC.
Stay with us.
Hide in your shell, 'cause the world is out to bleed you for a ride. What will you gain?
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. This week on Sideshow, our spin-off podcast, we talk to the great illustrator Christoph Niemann. He was on vacation this summer when the world spiraled out of control. Ukraine, Ebola, ISIS. Niemann responded by drawing an animated GIF. Maybe the most poignant GIF I've ever seen.
So I drew myself standing in the water reading a newspaper, which for me is like the ultimate moment of relaxation and happiness. And then you just have a very subtle drop of blood coming out of the newspaper, going into water, and then also dissolving.
You can hear that story at studio360.org/sideshow.
It's Saturday Night Live!
For a comedian, getting a job on Saturday Night Live is a big deal. Really, the big deal.
Featuring Jenny Slate.
Jenny Slate got that job at age 27, 5 years ago. And in her very first appearance, she made one of the worst mistakes you can make on live TV.
You freaking just threw an ashtray full of butts at my head. You know what? You stood up for yourself, and I f***ing love you for that.
You're in my heart, babe. You're in my heart.
Jenny Slate lasted only a year on SNL. But shortly after, she made a little stop-motion video with her filmmaker husband. It was about a character she called Marcel the Shell. It got more than 23 million views on YouTube and launched a best-selling children's book besides. Since then, Slate has been on TV shows like Parks and Recreation, House of Lies, Kroll Show, Bob's Burgers, and Married. And she starred in this summer's Kickstarter-funded Sundance-launched romantic comedy called Obvious Child. She plays a comedian who's trying to sort out the big issues of adulthood.
Kate has HPV, the kind of HPV where you get warts on your stuff and ovarian cancer. There's a lot of other stuff I could say, but I'm a lady. And then she dies of cancer and you're stuck with the bill, so...
I just wanted to apologize for the voicemail that I just left on your voicemail. And I also wanted to say, psych!
Jenny Slate, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So your involvement in Obvious Child goes back 5 years, which is half your adult lifetime by my reckoning. There was a short film before this movie occurred.
Yeah. 2009
was when we made the short film. It was written before I knew Gillian Robespierre, the writer and director. And we had a friend in common, and she came, and she ended up seeing me do stand-up and asked me to do the short.
And so your career has gone pretty gangbusters since then. Why did you stick with it? Why didn't you say, that was when I was young, that was a short film, I don't want to do this?
Well, it seems like that's the exact reason probably to stick with it. You know, she was somebody that I knew and I trusted, and she was smart, and the subject matter was dealt with in a way that I had just never seen or even heard of before.
Right.
And in a way, you put a lot, there's a lot of risk because you care about it, and kind of like not a lot of risk because when you make such a small indie film, like for very, very low budget, people might never see it.
Yeah. Well, but they're seeing this, and I want to talk about the subject matter. In addition to being a funny movie, your character decides to have an abortion after getting pregnant, which I think gets it extra praise from people on that side of the reproductive rights barricades, right? Apart from liking the movie and thinking it was important, I mean, did you think it was important to sort of in a kind of political way to show this character who decides to do that?
You know, now looking at it, after we finished it, I think that. I understand that. But going into it, my concern was, is it entertaining and is it useful?
Uh-huh.
And if it's, you know, like...
Useful?
Just, yeah. Is it useful to me? Do I get something out of it? And
not
it,
useful to the greater good? Or anything, no.
Not really. I don't think of myself on such, like, grand terms, or that's what I thought.
Yeah.
And then after we made the movie, I realized how many people were saying, like, there hasn't been anything like this before.
At your fancy prep school, Milton Academy, you were valedictorian. You were on the speech team. I don't know if that is a good thing or a bad thing.
Both.
You were class president. You went on to study literature at the Ivy League school, Columbia University.
Yeah.
When and how and where did comedy enter into this equation?
Always.
You were funny in high school?
I think I was funny at camp and then just trying to, like, keep my head down in high school.
Uh-huh.
What I realize now is that I just wanted to be an adult. I just wanted to be an adult woman. And growing up, I think the first glimpse I got of Lily Tomlin and Madeleine Kahn especially, and Carol Burnett and Gilda Radner, I just wanted to be that, which also meant adult woman.
Right. But were you thinking by the time you got to college, like, this is my career path. I'm not going to go to law school. I'm not going to, like, become a PhD.
Yeah. Oh, I always knew I would just do undergrad.
Uh-huh.
But my parents are both artists.
Right.
And so it wasn't
your father's
them.
A poet and your mother's a potter.
Yeah. She's a raku potter.
So they were okay with you just being the groovy artist that you became?
I'm many things. Yeah, no, they were fine with it.
Yeah.
I also have two sisters who are, like, you know, very responsible. So I was always a little bit of, like, the squiggle, you know.
As the middle child, you mean?
Yeah. We got these VHS tapes of SNL, like, the first 20 years or something. And I remember watching Gilda Radner and asking my dad about her. And he was like, yeah, you can do that.
And you went out and did stand-up starting when?
When I graduated from college in 2004, my best friend Gabe Liedman, who plays Joey in Obvious Child, he and I started as a duo. We tried to be in a sketch group with our other friends from Columbia, and then they all went to grad school. And it was just us.
Yeah. When you've done stand-up, are you a raunchy confessional comedian like your character, Donna, in
I think
Obvious
so.
Child? Yeah?
But Donna, really, she doesn't have the right type of boundaries, and...
So she's the extreme, unwell brought up version of you.
My subject matter is similar, although I wouldn't like talk about my husband in that way. I would never make fun of him, ever, or really be hurtful. Like, even if sometimes people are talking during my sets, I remember having to ask a man to be quiet and just saying, like, sir, can you please shut up? I'm really sorry, you know? And he was like, oh, sorry, you know? And he was just like a giant man. And then I also was just like, and please don't kill me. But also, like, beautiful muscles, you know? But that's as close as I'll go to, you know, being aggressive.
So you were on Saturday Night Live for
yes.
a season. And you said since that you didn't find it a very good fit. What do you mean by that? How so?
I'm just, I guess, too freeform, and I don't react well when there's a lot of fear in the environment for a reason that I don't understand.
And when you say fear, just because there are places, and we all know them, and some of us have worked in them, where that's part of the culture, and that was true there for you?
For me, I mean, you know, there's the fear of Tuesday night writing night. Like, will people accept you? There's the fear of the table read. Like, and it's just, I don't know. I guess sometimes I felt myself being like, well, one day we're all going to be 85. I hope we're proud of the way we're acting here.
Yeah.
I don't think we are.
Yeah.
You know, and essentially we all just poop in a toilet. Like, why are we acting like this is the biggest thing in the world? We're just trying to be entertaining. Like, what happened to the beating heart of it? I don't know. I just felt very incorrect. I felt very bad about myself.
And you grew up being amazed by Gilda Radner on Saturday Night Live. Obviously, Saturday Night Live is a thing for comic actors and comedians. Like, that's the place where it can be your launching pad to movie career, TV career. When you left that job after a year, did you say, well, that's it for my career? Did you have that feeling?
I was embarrassed, for sure. It's embarrassing to be fired. I felt sad because I liked everybody that I worked with a lot. Like, everybody was genuinely really nice. And I think I felt relief to be free. But mostly I felt relief because I felt like I'm so competitive in terms of trying to get things right. Or I used to be that way, more so than I am now, that I was like, I would have stayed there. I just would have stayed.
Right.
Just to try to make it right.
So better that the bad marriage ends quickly.
Yeah, I think so.
Your career didn't miss much of a beat looking back now at, you know, the last 5 years. And I wonder if you think it would have recovered as quickly as you did in a non-internet age. It seems like the web and all of that allowed you to, like, just get right back up and there be in everybody's faces and be funny.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I was so ready to be creative again when I left SNL, just to exercise those creative muscles. I never expected that, like, when my husband and I made Marcel the Shell, that it would become a viral thing or whatever. I didn't think of it that way. But I was very happy to just be doing something that I could never explain. Like, if I went in to a television network and was like, I'd like to make a series about a male shell, but he's not like a sea animal, but he has a googly eye and then shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just a documentary about nothing about him. They'd be like, this is a 0% idea.
Even in the age of 100 channels, that would be a hard pitch.
Hard sell. You gotta just do it.
This stop motion animated video you made, Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, was the first one. It became, as you say, this gigantic, gigantic viral hit. You now have a second children's book based on that character called Marcel the Shell, The Most Surprised I've Ever Been.
Yeah.
So it's a franchise for you. Can you read a little bit of that book sitting in front of you?
Sure. I'd love to.
Whatever bit makes sense to read.
I wrote this book with my husband, Dean Fleischer Camp, who also is the director and animator of the Marcel shorts, I should say, and also a cool person. He's a nice man.
One thing about a new day, you absolutely never know where it will go, even if you usually know where it starts. Usually in the morning, I get out of my bed and I start my day. I don't read the newspaper because it turns my shoes black, and I can't have coffee because one time I took a half a sip and I didn't blink for 5 hours. But that's not the surprise I wanted to tell you about. I wanted to tell you about the day I got the most surprised.
That's Jenny Slate reading from Marcel the Shell, The Most Surprised I've Ever Been, as Marcel.
Yeah.
Had you done that voice forever, or did that?
No.
Really?
I've never done it before. It's weird. It's weird. I don't know how it happened. I mean, I do know, like, when I started doing it over one weekend where I was packed into a motel room with, like, so many boys, and I just felt really small, and I started talking in that voice.
The books are lovely, the video's lovely, but the voice is a big part, don't you think, of why this has been successful?
I think so. I love the voice.
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to talk in it in our house, like in some situations, and I talk in it too much sometimes.
Do you? Really? Yeah. Just in real life?
Yeah, and sometimes I talk to myself in it. Like the other day, my friend, I was looking for something in my purse, and I was like,
oh, I'm never going to find it. Oh, God, there's too much garbage.
And he was like, is this what you do? You know, and it feels good to talk in it, and I don't know why I like it.
And does your husband like it, or does it just like, yeah, enough?
He likes it, but he doesn't like it when I do it to try to get out of doing stuff, like taking out the trash or like walking the dogs.
Being super cute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, uh-huh. I'm not allowed to do that, and I'm also obviously not allowed to do it during romantic times, but I would never do that.
You work with your husband mm-hmm. Productively, seemingly, and again. Is it hard to balance, to not only both be in show business, but to work together? Is that a difficult
thing? Sometimes it's hard, but I do feel very creatively comfortable around him.
Between all this other work you've done, you made a web series with your husband called Catherine.
Yeah.
It's this very eerie kind of David Lynchian comedy consisting of these short 2 or 3 minute episodes, which is also, it's innocent, like a workplace mystery written by a child or something.
Yeah.
I want to play a clip from Catherine where you're returning to work at an office. And I should say in advance to listeners that it sounds like not much is happening. And Catherine is not a hugely plot-driven, action-packed thing. But the smallest exchanges have this great sense of dread.
Good morning, Catherine.
Hi, Samantha.
You don't have any pins yet, and you don't have any paper.
Right. Well, if it's like before, I'll need to use them.
It is like before. How many would you like of each?
May I please have 3 pens and 100 sheets of paper?
Sure. I have rubber bands if you want those.
No, thank you.
I'll go get the pens and the paper.
Thanks, Sam.
You're welcome.
That's Jenny Slate laughing at herself.
I love Catherine. I think it's the funniest thing I've ever done. I think it's so funny.
It is very funny. And it's perfect in a way for 2 or 3 minutes. It can be that weird and stylized because it only lasts 2 or 3 minutes. Do you know?
Yes. That's part of the joy of it. It really, like, it started with my husband and I being really irritated at, like, Verizon commercials and stuff like that. They're like, the whole tone of them is, like, awkward, you know, like people looking to the side and being like, so, you know, and just, it's just, well, it's unbelievable. And we asked ourselves this question, like, what would it be like if everything was completely earnest and sincere and straightforward? And that, and we're not trying to do anything except for keep it totally neutral.
Right.
And it became like a game, and we started to write it together and could tell when things were too much. You know, like when they're ordering lunch, if the sandwiches were too jokey, you know. But like sometimes the sandwiches are just right and they make you laugh so hard the more you think about them, like plain chicken with plain bread.
No, it's like the Truman Show of banality or something.
Yeah,
you know?
I really like it. I'm really proud of it.
So while you're trying to become a big star and be in bigger movies and be on TV, you do this just because you have enough hours in the day to exercise this other creative channel?
I guess it just becomes so important to make sure you do those things, especially in an industry that's very risk averse and where things can often be seen as a product before they're a piece of art. You know, I mean, not to like sound like a douche about it, but when I met Dean, what I loved about him right away and why I wanted him to stay forever was because I thought of a life together where we could just make stuff and just be living in that. In like a biodome of our creation and living with those expectations that we can just live with creative stuff around us.
And by the way, create this book. Well, yeah. Given all this stuff and you just want to do these things you want to do because they seem cool, do you have – I mean, you've mentioned Gilda Radner and other actresses, actors as models. But do you have a career you look at and say, yeah, that one there, male or female, that looks pretty good to me, how that life went?
Hmm. I guess if I could have some sort of combination of like a really functional like Charles and Ray Eames situation.
I was thinking that myself.
With Dean, and then be kind of like a Ruth Gordon type of person who's like a lady who's really, really old and still in complete possession of her creative choices and her sexuality.
And married to a director as well, yeah. Like Garson Kanin. You know, you could be the Eameses, you can be Ruth Gordon and Garson Kanin. You got it.
Yeah.
I grant you your wish.
Thank you so much. I never knew I was going to get it, but I didn't know when I came in here today this is what it would be. But, yeah.
Jenny Slate, it has been a pleasure. I really enjoyed meeting you. Thanks.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
Jenny Slate's new book for kids, Marcel the Shell, The Most Surprised I've Ever Been, comes out this month. You can watch her in the movie Obvious Child and the FX show Married, which are both streaming online right now. And you can hear a longer version of our conversation at studio360.org. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thanks for listening, and please, pretty please, listen next time. And look out for us on Facebook, where we post links to great things every single day. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramaswaram,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Pinnamaneni,
Krista Ripple,
Zoe Azule,
Amira Nader,
Scott Ross.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, a composer from Alaska won the Pulitzer Prize for a piece inspired by the polar ice melt. Composer John Luther Adams, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.